Each week at this time, we select a topic, an important topic, a serious topic, to explore with people who will give us a different perspective. Today, the major cabinet changes for President Obama's second term, the legacy of those leaving, and what is to be expected of the new nominees. Normally, when you talk about an appointment to a cabinet position, people yawn. People have no interest. The average person has no understanding of the background of almost any of the people who are selected, unless they're a national hero, like Colin Powell. However, for the vast majority of individuals, they will hear that there is some debate, some support, and some challenge. We're interested in what does this mean for the rest of us as a country? What does it mean for people around the world? And hence, we have assembled a group of individuals to share their substantial expertise on the major cabinet changes of President Obama's second term. Our panel will be Ray McGovern from North Virginia. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George W. Bush. Among his duties was preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. Now, since retiring from government service, he's been one of our nation's most vocal peace activists and journalists. In 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. His opinion pieces appear in many leading newspapers here and abroad, including a major section in an important book, Neoconned Again, dealing with America's War in Iraq. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University and is a graduate from Harvard's Business School and has a certificate of theology from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com and consortiumnews.com. He then will be joined by Professor Stephen Zunes. That's Z-U-N-E-S. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern studies. He is recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of Middle East policy and a strategic nonviolent action expert. He received his Ph.D. from Cornell University and previously served on the faculty of Ithaca College and the University of Puget Sound and Whitman College. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And he's also an associate editor of Peace Review and is a contributing editor to the gentleman who will follow us tonight on the Rebbe and the Radical and the Preacher, Tikkun Magazine, Rabbi Michael Lerner. And among his most recent publications are Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Resolution. His website is stephenzunes.org. They will be joined later in the program at the half-hour mark by Robert Scheer from Los Angeles. For the past 30 years, Robert Scheer has built a reputation as one of the nation's most honest and insightful political writers. From 1976 to 93, he was a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, reporting on the Cold War, arms control, and national politics. He is a professor at the University of Southern California, Annenberg School of Journalism, and editor-in-chief of Webby award-winning internet magazine TruthDig.com. He is regularly heard on NPR program Left, Right, and Center. And his recent book is The Great American Stick-Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street. His website, truthdig.com. And our final panelist at the end of the program will be Catherine Austin Fitz from Tennessee. She is the president of Solary, Inc. and a publisher of the Solary Report. Earlier, Catherine served as a managing director and a member of the board of directors for the Wall Street investment bank Dillon Reed and was the assistant secretary of housing and federal housing commissioner at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development during the first Bush administration. And her website is solary.com. Let us begin by welcoming our first two panelists, Ray McGovern and Professor Stephen Zunis. Nice to have you both with us today.
Good to be on.
Thank you.
Ray, we're going to start with you, please. Take us on a journey to understand some of the individuals that that are virtually unknown to most Americans, especially since John Brennan is being nominated and to head the CIA, and yet we think of General Petraeus, he is portrayed in the media as a major American hero. Little is understood of what really happened with the surge that he took credit for of stopping the conflict in Iraq against Americans principally. So would you give us a background on who John Brennan is, why we should be concerned about him, and what he has said on the record, and what the record has shown to be the veracity of his statements? The form is yours.
Sure. I know John Brennan. He was a young analyst on the Middle East when I was working on the President's Daily Brief, and occasionally he would serve up a draft for me to work on. Sometimes his drafts even were salvageable, and I could use them in the President's Daily Brief. In a word, he's a failed analyst. He really couldn't make it as an analyst. He was not getting promoted, and so he, like many other people do, he found a way to get down to the White House as a kind of a helper down there. And as luck would have it for him, he impressed a fellow named George Tenet. Now, George Tenet, of course, was a White House official responsible for the White House looking over intelligence activities. And when Tenet became deputy director and then director of the CIA, he brought Brennan with him because Brennan had the kind of qualities that impress George Tenet, namely a willingness to carry out whatever George Tenet wanted him to do. And but long story short, he became Tenet's chief of staff, and then he became deputy executive director. A big deal. This is a person who was moved up about as quickly as old Bobby Gates was when I was still around there in the agency, and because he knew which way the wind was blowing, and he certainly trimmed his sails. Now, there's a lot on the books about Brennan. He's an open advocate, the staunch defender of what's called extraordinary rendition, also known as kidnapping, kidnapping for torture, black holes, black sites around the world where people were kept without telling their wives or children, much less the Red Cross, for obvious reasons. And then he was also a very early urger of candidate Obama to change his mind about illegal eavesdropping. Now, this was a biggie. General Hayden, who is head of NSA, our eavesdropping outfit out there in the National Security Agency, he was approached by Cheney and the others, and they said, now, look, you know, after 9-11, everything changed, right? And so that first commandment that you have out there at NSA, namely, thou shalt not eavesdrop on American citizens without a court warrant. That's passé. Are you game? Are you game, Michael Hayden? And he said, yes, sir, sure I'm game. And so they started monitoring all our telephone calls and our emails and everything else in direct violation of the law, the FISA law. That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it's a felony, okay? Well, they were caught, of course. And AT&T, Verizon, the big giants were, you know, they're being sued. They were clearly culpable and liable for increased damages. So Obama said he would vote against any bill that held them harmless for these felonies. But Brennan and the others said, you don't want to do that because, you know, because we're really handy to capture all this stuff. And make a long story short again, Obama changed his mind even before the election and voted to hold these giants harmless. I'll just finish up by saying what really hurts, okay? And it's this. I came out of almost 30 years of intelligence analysis, okay? That's not, you know, kidnapping people or putting them in prison or shooting hellfire missiles at them. That's the function that Harry Truman set up the CIA for, namely to give them the straight scoop on what's going on in the world without fear or favor, okay? And we were able to do that for the most part in my day. 27 years, I was able to do that, and I had career protection for doing that. Well, after 9/11, everything changed, right? So what happened? Well, they decided that they'd like to make war on Iraq, and President Bush and Dick Cheney looked around and said to George Tenet, hey, can you dig up, can you contrive, fabricate some intelligence that would justify this? And Tenet thought that it was his job to do that, and so he went back, and with Brennan, in full knowledge, since he was originally an analyst himself, they were responsible for, you know, what I would consider the mortal sin, and that's this. Falsifying intelligence for the express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. It doesn't get any worse than that. And so that's when we formed our little alumni organization, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. That was over 10 years ago. We're still watching things very closely, and there's some cause for optimism now, but not with Brennan, with Hagel. I'm filibustering here, so I ought to stop so my friend Stephen can say his piece.
Before we go to Stephen, I'd like one follow-up from you, if you would, please. The entire basis of going to war in Iraq, from the official position, was weapons of mass destruction and, you know, stopping them. And we were told by all the people, from Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and others, that there were weapons of mass destruction. They had absolute proof of it, and the intelligence showed that. And even at the UN, before the national audience and the National Security Agency, everybody else, they said, here's the proof. Now we find out that virtually everything they told us was untrue. Here's my question for you. Everyone has been given a pass by the mainstream media for this simple reason. We were told it was an honest error. They simply made the best judgment they could with the best intelligence they had. My sub-question: is it possible that in the White House, away from the CIA, that a separate group of intelligence operatives willing to go down that road, in effect of manufacturing intelligence, taking real intelligence out of context, subordinating perjury, if need be, and in effect creating a false story that it could be sold with plausible deniability, was given to the American public? And if that is the case, if it is the case, and you certainly would know far more than I or others, then would they not be held liable for crimes against humanity because of all the consequences and all the people who have died and been victimized in Iraq, Americans and others, and Kurds, and because of that? Your thoughts?
Well, those are the $64 questions, and I thank you for asking them. First off, we have George W. Bush and others saying, well, what a terrible mistake. People ask George Bush, do you regret anything about your tenure as president? He said, oh, yes, that mistaken intelligence on Iraq, I would have done it anyway. Well, friends, please, it wasn't a mistake. It was fraud. It was fraudulent. Now, as hard as that is to believe, it would be much nicer to believe the kind of scenario that you suggest as one alternative, namely some sort of little coup in the White House where the people, including perhaps George Tenet, womp this conspiracy up. But I'm afraid that that's not the case. The case is that Tenet and this group of malleable managers that grew up in the CIA over the two decades before, starting with Bill Casey and Bobby Gates politicizing the agency, that they were all too willing accomplices. What happened? Well, there was a 5-year Senate Intelligence Committee investigation of what happened, And when they issued their report, bipartisan, by the way, because Chuck Hagel and one of those women from Maine, one of those senators, I forget which one, voted with the majority. And what did Jay Rockefeller say as he unveiled this five-year study? He said, the intelligence that was adduced to justify the war in Iraq was, and I quote, uncorroborated, contradicted, or even non-existent, end quote. Now I ask you, what does non-existent intelligence look like? Looks like forgery, looks like things conjured up. It looks like the worst, and that's what really hurts, because I was about to give up on even the analysis division of the CIA when a wonderful thing happened. And I'll just take another minute. After the debacle, after the demonstrated forgeries and all that kind of stuff, they decided that, well, Iran's next, but this time let's get somebody with some honest cachet, somebody who may have been sort of right on Iraq, and they picked out Tom Finger, who was the head of analysis, intelligence analysis at the State Department. He came in, did a bottom-up assessment of the nuclear capability of Iran, was the recipient of some very fortunate new intelligence, and in November of 2007, his national intelligence estimate that he supervised declared that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, and had not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Whoa! That was a bombshell. Why do I emphasize that? Well, it was a product of honest work, and it's the first time and only time in the 50 years that I've been very close to all this business here in Washington, the only time I could say that a national intelligence estimate played a huge role in preventing a war, because that's what Bush and Cheney intended for their last year in office. They were out to get Iran. The juggernaut was rolling off. And if you don't believe me, just look at page 419 of Bush's memoir, which he says, oh, that estimate tied my hands on the military side. And then this wonderful quote, for how can I justify ordering our military to strike the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? How could I? End quote. Bummer. You would think that if Bush and Cheney were really worried about a nuclear weapon in Iran's hands, their appropriate reaction to that estimate would have been, are you sure? Do you check that? You mean they're not working? Whoa! It was just the opposite. So truth is stranger than fiction. First of all, it wasn't a mistake. It was fraudulent. Some of my old colleagues were actually involved in this, to my great regret. But things are better now, and nobody's going to falsify an estimate on Iran, and that is a very, very good thing.
Thank you. Please hold on, because I'm going to come back and get your thoughts in a little while after we speak with Professor Zunis on Chuck Hagel. Now, to you, Professor, could you please give us your perspective on another appointment that's coming up for Secretary of State, John Kerry, especially in light of many people on the left or progressives or corporate Democrats who support Kerry based upon what he did early in his career, which was noble, and he came off on the right side of history on that. But then they seem to have lost track of where he went off the radar, and then showed up more often than not as a neocon supporting very Bush doctrine policies. So could you take us down this path to show us the real John Kerry of today? And what would be the likely, I realize this is subjective, but the best you can, the likely way that he would deal with Middle Eastern issues, including Iran, where we have a potential for great conflict, Syria, Israel, the Palestinian conflict, and whether or not he would actually do something about the lack of human rights, the lack of democratic processes, or even a movement in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and other countries that claim that they are for peaceful means of supporting democratic movements, but in actuality have a very hard hand, and we are supporting their hard-handedness, as had Hillary Clinton had. The forum is yours.
Well, first of all, John Kerry was very much a part of this deception of the American people on the supposed so-called weapons of mass destruction of Iraq. He stood up on the Senate floor and said categorically that Iraq not only had chemical and biological weapons arsenal, but they were more advanced than they were at the time before the Gulf War of 1991. He claimed that all experts agree that Iraq has a nuclear weapons program, when in fact it was public knowledge and reported in newspapers across the country, though not enough, as well as in arms control journals and even by two detailed reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency, that Iraq in fact no longer had a nuclear weapons program. He claimed that Iraq had unarmed aerial vehicle. Had unmanned aerial vehicles and other sophisticated delivery systems. Went down the whole, the very lies that the Bush administration had been putting out. Even though he had been briefed personally by Scott Ritter, the chief UN weapons inspector. And his staff had been briefed by quite a few people, myself included, that had done our own research and came to similar conclusions that Iraq had achieved at minimum qualitative disarmament and perhaps total disarmament. And to this day, he has refused to allow me or any other independent strategic analyst to see the supposed evidence he supposedly saw that supposedly said Iraq had these threats. So that's the first thing, that he seemed to be part of this broader deception. In fact, I called his press office today in anticipation of this interview, giving him yet another chance to try to show me the case whether indeed he had been fooled. But they refused. But more in many ways worse than that was that unlike Chuck Hagel, who at least while supporting voting in the initial resolution to support the war, quickly went in opposition, Kerry doubled down. When he was running for president in 2004, he said he would have supported the war resolution even if he had known Iraq didn't have any of these weapons or weapon systems. He said just by the fact that Iraq had the potential to develop these weapon systems and it was an oppressive government, that alone gave the United States the right to unilaterally invade. Now, there are literally dozens of countries that have oppressive governments that have the capability, theoretically, to develop biological and chemical weapons. And he's saying basically we have the right to invade any of them now. A very extreme position, and so this raises some pretty serious questions, especially given this is a clear violation of the United Nations Charter, international law. We've seen his statements on Israel-Palestine. Goes beyond the traditional kind of hawkishness in supporting the Likud and their policies to, for example, declaring that the International Court of Justice has no right to give even an advisory opinion on Israel's conduct in the occupied territories in terms of international humanitarian law. Kerry takes the argument that Israeli domestic courts should be the ones to decide. Now, think about this for a minute. He's saying that if a country invades and occupies another country, that the United Nations, the International Court of Justice have no jurisdiction. It should be purely the jurisdiction of the legal system of the occupying power. and when you combine this sort of thing along with his position on Iraq, you're seeing someone who basically is saying to hell with 20th century international law, to hell with the United Nations system. He wants to go back to a 19th century right of conquest. So this is literally a reactionary foreign policy, and this is this. I mean, this shows that, you know, I mean, this is a bad signal to both our allies and adversaries. This is saying that we are basically continuing this very dangerous and neoconservative style worldview of the Bush administration.
A follow-up question. Considering the power of China, India, Brazil, South Korea, and other aligned countries, and Russia, would it not make more sense to have someone as Secretary of State who is looking for a way for us to find things in common that we could use to support one another and also at the same time to disarm in a unilateral way, everyone begin the process, rather than someone who holds a highly adversarial position towards China, and by most indicators, China could become the world's leading economy within the next 3 to 5 years. We've already borrowed almost close to $1.7 trillion from China. Surely we should have a different way of dealing with it rather than supporting as what Obama has done and his secretary of, and Panetta and others and Gates. This idea of putting stations, military stations in Australia and New Zealand and Thailand and Vietnam. What are your thoughts on that, please?
Well, I think as the United States, relatively speaking, is losing its predominant position in the world, it seems to be, even putting aside the moral and legal arguments, it would seem to be very much in our own self-interest to recognize that international law is the, you know, despite its failures in many respects, is the best way to maintain some semblance of global order. But you know, Kerry's bashing of the United Nations, his support for unilateralism, and his attacks on those who disagree with him it's not the kind of thing we want in the Secretary of State. I mean, just to give one example, when Spanish Prime Minister Zapatero announced that he was fulfilling a campaign promise to withdraw Spanish troops from Iraq as a result of the Bush administration's failure to put the post-invasion, you know, occupation order under the leadership of the United Nations, he denounced the Spanish Prime Minister as giving in to terrorism. Similarly, he denounced Kofi Annan for supporting a nearly unanimous decision by the UN General Assembly to forward the question about Israel's separation wall in the occupied territories as effectively being soft on terrorism. The court decision, incidentally, said Israel had every right to build a separation barrier. It just had to be on its internationally recognized border. It couldn't be built in this serpentine, you know, fashion in somebody else's land as a as part of a land grab. But in other words, if you don't support the policies of the United States and its right-wing allies, you are therefore giving in to terrorism. And he similarly denounced some of his Democratic opponents, like Howard Dean, when Dean said we should include the United Nations and work in more of a multilateral fashion. He was basically saying, oh, he wants to tie our hands with this and just an excuse for doing nothing and not supporting our self-defense. And he accused Kerry of being anti-Israel when he said that the peace process might go better if the United States was a little more even-handed. So it's not just his policies, it's his whole demeanor in terms of those who disagree with him. Fills this kind of stereotype that many people elsewhere in the world have of this arrogance of American policymakers, and to have somebody like that as Secretary of State, it really, really sends the wrong signal, I would argue.
I have one final question on this issue before we move on, and I'm going to go back to Ray McGovern for the same question. When the Arab Spring began, and we saw the efforts of mainly young unemployed people who were not necessarily looking to overthrow the entire regime or everything associated with it, but they wanted jobs. They did not want to be any longer part of any of the austerity programs. You had a lot of highly educated people, but didn't have work to support themselves and their families. It took months of them protesting in Tunisia and Egypt and other countries before we even looked in the direction of supporting them. All the while, we continued to support those governments, including in Bahrain and including in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, with intelligence information as well as defense support. And Secretary of State Clinton did not come forward and address this. What is your view of Secretary of State Clinton? Many of us, myself included, think that the reason that she accepted Secretary of State was simply to fill out a big gap in her resume for her to run in 2016 election and probably win at that time. What is her legacy? What weren't we paying attention to, and how has the media substantially neglected to show her policies that she was, not policies she was caring for, but as the messenger of the policies out of the White House?
Yeah, I don't want to speculate on her motivations, but she certainly did play a negative role in terms of U.S. policy regarding the pro-democracy uprisings in the Middle East. I mean, it's interesting, historically, the National Security Council, which reports directly to the president, has been somewhat more hawkish than the State Department. But under Obama, it's been just the opposite, because Obama, for most, though not all, NSC positions, you know, tended to appoint people who, while very much part of the foreign policy establishments, tended to be a bit younger, a bit more innovative, tended to have opposed the Iraq war. Whereas in the State Department, as part of his deal of getting Clinton to be Secretary of State, gave her pretty much free rein to do most of the key appointments there. And so she brought in some of the older, more hawkish people, a majority of whom supported the Iraq war, many people veterans of her husband's administration. And so in the dramatic days of the Egyptian Revolution, also in Tunisia, while many people in the White House, including President Obama himself, were starting to lean towards avoiding being on the wrong side of history and supporting the democratic transitions, both the Secretary of State Clinton as well as Secretary of Defense Robert Gates pushed back really, really hard about with the United States staying in support of these regimes. We've seen some other issues ranging from Honduras to Western Sahara, where, you know, the White House would make some statements that would sound like they were somewhat more enlightened, only to have the State Department to come down really hard in support of, in the case of Honduras, the military coup, in the case of Western Sahara, for the ongoing Moroccan occupation. And indeed, Clinton's record on human rights in general has been very poor. This is one area where I think Kerry might be a slight improvement, because he was one of the early people in Congress to call for the United States to distance itself from Mubarak and the like. But Clinton's legacy in this area has been very, very disappointing.
I appreciate your insights. Professor Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies, University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies, my guest. Back for a final comment to Ray McGovern. Ray, would you please give us your insights on Chuck Hagel and as Secretary of Defense, and also the same cast of characters, Leon Panetta, who had been at CIA, over to Secretary of Defense. And all these people seem to be Washington insiders, that it doesn't matter which administration, they seem to be interchangeable. And what you don't see is you don't see really good people capable of handling these positions who are not like war hawks or neocons. Your thoughts on Chuck Hagel and his predecessor, Leon Panetta?
Well, Panetta was a terrible disappointment to me. When he was appointed to be head of the CIA, it was very clear that the president simply wanted him to be the lawyer for the CIA, to schmooze with his old friends in Congress and get the money for the CIA. He did nothing. He came in and he did nothing in terms of getting rid of the torturers, the kidnappers, the wardens of these black prisons, the interceptors of all our communications. So he was a terrible disappointment, and as the Secretary of Defense, he simply fell into that role, and he tried to make believe he was Bobby Gates. Now, the interesting thing here is that Hegel is different. When I heard that Hegel was being thought, you know, the trial balloons, you know, Obama seems to love to send up trial balloons and see how many shots people take at it before he ever does anything, but this time, even though there was a lot of flack that hit that trial balloon, I was gratified that this time Obama hung in there and nominated Chuck Hagel. Now, why am I happy about that? Well, number one, Chuck Hagel has been there, done that, okay? He's the only Secretary of Defense in 30 years that anybody ever shot at, okay? He was in Vietnam, as people know. He had two Purple Hearts. He volunteered to go to Vietnam. The draft board in Nebraska told him, look, Chuck, you know, all you have to do is sign up for college again. You don't have to go to Vietnam. And he said, no, I want to go to Vietnam. So they gave him orders to Europe. He said, look, I want to go to Vietnam, and my brother does too. And that's the kind of guy Chuck Hagel is, as opposed to these other folks that got all these deferments or joined the champagne unit of the Air National Guard in Texas and that kind of thing. Cheney, as we know, had five deferments. How many did Joe Biden have? Anybody know? Raise your hand. Five, okay? So these are folks that don't know what war is like. Chuck Hagel does, and he's already said very explicitly it's going to take a lot to persuade him to send young men and women off to war. On dubious reasons, for a fool's errand such as we had and we have in Afghanistan and Iraq and, God forbid, Iran. That's the big thing, Iran. That's what the neocons, the folks there in our government that, how shall I say, well, they have extreme difficulty distinguishing between the strategic objectives and needs of Israel on the one hand and those of the United States of America on the other. And so they're really chary of Hegel because get this, listen to this. Do you know what he had the effrontery to say? He had the effrontery to say, look, I'm the senator from Nebraska in the United States. I'm not the senator from Israel. Whoa. Well, you know, on the face of it, doesn't that make sense? Well, that's regarded as not quite kosher, so to speak, in this context. So, long story short here, last year saw a real roller coaster in relations between the United States and Israel. And we're going to have come up on the Super Bowl in a week or so. At last year's Super Bowl, Obama very, very loudly said to Matt Lauer, look, my main strategic purpose here is the defense of the United States and also Israel. I looked at it and I said, wait a second here. Don't we deserve our own separate sentence? Couldn't you say the United States, period, and then, oh, I'm also interested in securing Israel? No. And then he went on in that same paragraph to say, with respect to Iran, that big menace, that big non-existent menace between us, with respect to Iran, we are working in lockstep with Israel. Whoa. Did Obama not know what lockstep means? That's the procedure they used on prisoners, most of them black, in the South in the two centuries ago, all right? There's a big line, okay, you put your right hand on the right shoulder of the man in front, you're shackled, and you have a ball on your left leg. And the way you move forward in lockstep is a gingerly step forward with the right foot, and you kind of swing the left foot with the ball on it. And if anybody gets out of lockstep, man, you fall down. It's a real mess, okay? That was the image he had used. Okay, now that was February of last year. How about August, September, October? Oh, what a change. with all Netanyahu's ranting and raving about the non-existent threat from Iran, finally, the president, well, he couldn't quite get himself to do it himself, but he authorized the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Morton Dempsey, to say, I don't want to be complicit. The Israelis attack Iran. Whoa! August 30th, look it up. That's what Dempsey says publicly. Two weeks later, Hillary Clinton. I don't think these red lines that Netanyahu draws, I don't think they make much sense. One week later, the president himself. I'm too busy. I have to go on to The View and a few other TV programs. Sorry, BB, but I won't be able to meet you, Netanyahu, when you come to the UN in September. Whoa! So, my big question was, what would the continuity be into the second term? Would it be October or September? Or would it be February of last year? And when he picked Hagel, he said, whoa, it looks like last fall, much more than last winter and spring. And when he stuck with it, I was deathly afraid he was going to cave like he usually does. When he stuck with Hagel, I said, well, this is a major thing. Because Hagel knows about war. He's not going to send our troops into a situation where they get involved in a war with Iran, which would make Iraq look like a volleyball game between Mount St. Ursula and St. Helena's Academy, for God's sake. You know, this would be real war. And so I'm very relieved that it looks like Obama's sticking with Hagel. I'm pretty sure he'll be confirmed. And Kerry, well, in my view, Kerry's a wuss, okay? He had some good instincts before he developed bad instincts. With a guy like Hagel around, you know, there's always a chance that Hagel's guts will be contagious and that Kerry will revert to his former self and say, yeah, well, I guess we shouldn't send people into this god-awful wars like the one I participated in Vietnam. So there's good news and bad news. Good news is Hagel. Bad news, people like Brennan, people like Kerry, who does not have a good record. I agree completely with Stephen on that. So we'll have to see what comes forward, but I'm more optimistic than I was before that finally, maybe the president got a spinal implant or something during the Christmas holidays, because he looks like he's willing to stand up to the Israel lobby and to others in a way that was absent during his first term.
Well, clearly AIPAC's shadow war against Chuck Hagel is taking form. They're mainly using Josh Block, who does not work for AIPAC anymore, but calls directly to AIPAC daily and is their mouthpiece. But because he no longer is officially with them, they can say, well, we're being neutral, but they're not neutral at all. And very few legislators have ever had the courage to stand up to AIPAC and say, go away. I'm going to look at this with my own eyes, make my own decision about Israel and Palestine and other conditions. I thank you very much, Ray McGovern, for your insights. We're going to go over now and speak with Robert Scheer about other appointments, including Secretary of the Treasury appointment in a moment. Just one final thought, and this is not for response, just a thought. Many of us are concerned that we have not been given the real, full, honest answer of what happened the night that Osama bin Laden was shot. The primary person who communicated what happened was John Brennan. But there have been multiple contradictions in what he told us. Now, as they were all sitting there in the White House and all had the capacity to see in real time what was actually occurring, they shouldn't have been wrong in any of their statements. And I'm just curious, if this man was as important as he claimed to be, why couldn't they have captured him, brought him back? Would he not have been far more valuable alive, knowing what he would have known about Saudi Arabia terrorism as being one of the architects? I'm concerned that there's still a part of that story that we have been either been misled about, haven't been given all the facts, and I believe that there's still a discussion to be had on that. And Brennan, of course, was the one who was giving us the official position. So, Ray McGovern, possibly on another occasion, you could come back to discuss that with us.
Happy to do that.
Thank you, Ray McGovern. Now, Robert Scheer from Los Angeles. I gave your background earlier on in the program. Nice to have you with us today.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Good. Let us take a look through your eyes at the work of Jack Lew, who is now being considered to take the place of Timothy Geithner. I'd also like for you to take a look at Timothy Geithner And the part especially that intrigues me is how could we have a person, Jack Lew, who was fully aware and one of the people in on the original removal of some of our essential protective mechanisms that have been put in place by FDR, and consider him to be important for the American public when he is a person that is very much a believer in Wall Street and the marketplace having precedence in all things. Your thoughts, please. Tell us about this man and his background.
Yeah, my problem is not with the marketplace. My problem is with the power of these guys to rig the marketplace and deceive most Americans, and then when they mess up, get the rest of us to finance their bailout. And what happened was that, you know, Robert Rubin was the guy who talked Clinton into cooperating with the Republicans, with Phil Graham, to do away with the New Deal. They've been trying to do that ever since the Great Depression and couldn't get a majority. And then Bill Clinton was the one who engineered that triangulation. And Robert Rubin was the guy. And then Robert Rubin had these people working for them. One was Timothy Geithner. Another was Jake Lew. And, you know, they were in on it from the beginning. And the whole idea was let Wall Street do its thing, you know, whatever that is, and we'll somehow all benefit. Well, we didn't benefit. They did these toxic securitization packages. They ripped people off of their homes. We have 50 million Americans that have either lost their homes or deep underwater. It's caused great tragedy throughout the country. The economy's not bouncing back. We have enormous debt as a result. The economy's been hobbled now for a very long time. And the idea that you reward these people by putting them in charge of the effort to repair the damage, and it's like going to the mafia or something and say, hey, help us fight organized crime, and you put him in as head of the FBI. That's what's happening here. And Jake Lew is a guy who, like Robert Rubin, went to work for Citigroup, the one bank that couldn't exist. It was too big to fail. It was in violation of the old Glass-Steagall regulations. They make that legal. Robert Rubin goes to work there. He makes $15 million, $20 million a year. And then he brings in Jake Lew. And Jake Lew is one of the guys who put packages together, security packages, bet against homeowners, and one of the individuals who's responsible for Citigroup having to be bailed out. And yet the very year he was doing that, 2008, he made $2 million for his efforts. So I think what it shows is the Obama administration is not going to do anything to reverse course. A course set by George W. Bush was bail out the banks, but don't worry about their victims. Don't do anything for them. Let them sink or swim.
When you look at this from your perspective, what would you say to President Obama if you had a chance to sit with him about this particular appointee?
I'd ask him what happened to him. I mean, this is a guy when he ran for office in 08 and he was running against Hillary Clinton, he had it pegged. He blamed these policies. He said this whole effort to free Wall Street was a disaster. And then when Hillary went down, this guy turned to the very same people in the Clinton administration, Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers, and others, and said, I want Wall Street on my side. He gave up campaign finance reform, public funding of the campaign. He instead took more money from Wall Street than any other sector, and he paid them off during the first 4 years. He followed exactly the policy of the George W. Bush administration, which, as I say, you know, bail out the bankers, but not the people that are hurting. He didn't do anything for mortgage relief. He didn't really do anything significant to keep people in their homes. And a lot of people I know kept thinking, well, it's going to be better in his second term. And the sad news is that with this appointment, it means it's not going to be any different because Jake Lew is one of them. And it'll be one thing if the guy had, like Gary Gensler over at Commodity Futures Trading Commission, he's had some kind of a conversion. He's admitted they were wrong. Even Alan Greenspan has said, you know, they did things wrong. But not Jake Lew. Jake Lew testified before Congress that he didn't think these packages and everything, these toxic assets, had anything to do with it. So he's a guy who doesn't even see the need for reform.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. At the time of the bailout, the original TARP bailout, Larry Summers, not just Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury, who also came from Goldman Sachs, but Larry Summers was one of the most aggressive and outspoken of Obama's economic advisors. And he said that without this bailout, all of our economy would go over the cliff, and they had to be bailed out, and there'd be reform because of this. I have spoken with many economists since, and I've asked this basic question. These too big to fail, let's just take four of them, the too big to fail major Wall Street banks. Could there not have been a way to have taken them through structured bankruptcy, to have eliminated their toxic assets, to taken away their derivative positions so it no longer was a potential liability, and get rid of the people who had put them in this place, and like any other corporation, learn some lessons from it? And I'm interested in your response to that same question, because Lou and Geithner and the head of the Federal Reserve, Bernanke, they've all had the same voice. We have to keep bailing them out. Right now it's $40 billion in toxic mortgages plus another $40 billion. They're buying up the bonds. They're the biggest bond donors right now. And we're told that if they don't keep bailing them out, they're surely going to cause a collapse. At what point do we say enough and take a different strategy? I'd like your insight, please.
Well, first of all, even before you get to that point, you could say to the banks, if we're going to bail you out, you're also going to bail out the homeowners. It's actually in your long-term interest. And so even if you think there should have been help for the banks, the first thing you do is you say, look, we're going to give you some money here, but you're going to do mortgage adjustment with the people you swindled. You're going to, you know, play fair with them. You're going to follow the rules now. Instead, no, the money was thrown at them, and not just, and you're absolutely right to point out that we're continuing to throw money at them, the $40 billion a month to take toxic assets off their books. The virtually free money, you know, people listening to this show, some of them may be paying 25-30% on their credit cards. The banks still charge good interest, you know, you know, they get free money. And the homeowners don't get free money. And so that's the first thing. I mean, a deal was made to save the banks and get nothing back from them. And some of the state attorneys general, like the one in California, Kamala Harris, pushed back, but they couldn't really. The Obama administration pretty much stopped them, got a pittance. So that's number one. Secondly, you're absolutely right. If they're too big to fail, you know, they should have been allowed to fail, and that would have sent the right lesson. And you can go through bankruptcy. The newspaper that I worked for 29 years, the Los Angeles Times, was bought by the Chicago Tribune, Tribune Corporation. They went through bankruptcy. They've now emerged from bankruptcy. Other companies have gone through bankruptcy. There's no reason why Citigroup couldn't have gone through bankruptcy and protected the depositors and so forth. That could be done. And it's interesting you mentioned Summers, because Summers is the guy who testified in defense of this radical deregulation. He said, these people know what they're doing on Wall Street. They can be trusted. They have the information. And if you don't free them to do their thing, we're going to all be in big trouble. And at the same time, he was making $8.5 million from the D.E. Shaw hedge fund and from Citigroup and from, you know, Goldman Sachs. He was getting these big speaking fees. He goes, gives a 20-minute speech. He gets, you know, $80,000. So unbelievable. And again, I would use the analogy with the Mafia. If some guy had that kind of a record, they wouldn't be running around still giving a lot of advice, and they certainly wouldn't be brought in to run the FBI or something. And that's what happened here. The guys who were, you know, made out like bandits, the Robert Rubens and the Lawrence Summers, their proteges, their acolytes, were brought in to somehow make it better. And for most people, it's not better. The fact is they've lost, you know, a lot of their wealth, a lot of their savings, and their houses are still underwater. So it's a great human tragedy. You lose your house, your kids got to pull out of school, you know, you can't support your lifestyle. It's terrible. And there's been no real support for ordinary homeowners, and there's been a great deal of support for the big bankers who caused all these problems.
Very good insights. I'll just close with this thought. I'm concerned that we can turn around and give a total of over $19 trillion, $16.1 trillion, according to Bernie Sanders of Vermont in an audit of the Fed, and $740 billion and another $3.1 trillion at virtually zero interest, 0.25 interest, and using toxic assets as collateral. That's economic alchemy. And yet we cannot, as a nation, nor our policymakers, agree that maybe it would be in the best interest of the citizens if we brought the value of their mortgages to the value of the marketplace, so at least they would be able to stay in their homes. And if we took away these double-click interest rates, and since we took away all debt from any of the banks, 100% of their debt, and gave them clean money, why couldn't we do the same thing with students who have are out of college now, so they're getting that compounding interest, and if they don't pay it, they could actually go to jail? Why can't we forgive that? Why can't we forgive some of the credit card debt? Why can't we forgive some of the interest on homeowners' mortgages? If we have the absolute resolve to help tens of trillions of dollars with Wall Street, why don't we have any resolve to do the same thing for the average person? A quick answer from you,
please. Well, because we don't control the U.S. government, and Wall Street does. I mean, my God, I covered this for the L.A. Times for a decade. I watched their lobbyists running all around Washington. They wrote the bills. They provided the key testimony, and they are the ones who lavishly finance the people who win. It's a far cry from the kind of yeoman democracy that the founders had in mind. I mean, so that's the reality. It's very depressing.
Robert Scheer, thank you for being with us today and all, for always your great, outstanding investigative journalistic work.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. That brings us to the end of this Progressive Commentary Hour, looking into the backgrounds of those who otherwise would virtually have no discussion by experts who have very specific insights and opinions. I want to thank my guests, Ray McGovern, Professor Stephen Zunis, and Robert Scheer. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.